The Football Show on Off The Ball.
Brought to you by the Boyle Sports app. Cash out and in-play betting available in the App Store and Google Play Store.
I'm prepared to do anything I can to play my country again.
Do it then.
What about your start to the game?
It wasn't bad, was it?
Why should an honest answer be a mistake?
How can a modern day manager not have a mobile phone?
Why should he?
So, as you can see, I am holding in my hand Heads Up, Alan Smith's autobiography, and conveniently, Alan Smith joins us on the line. I'm not just holding this up randomly. Hello, Alan.
Hello, mate. How are you?
Yeah, great. Thanks very much for joining us. So, risky move. You decided to write this thing yourself, which is no easy task. I know you've been writing your own Telegraph columns for 20 years, but it's a daunting enough thing, you know, to write it completely yourself?
Well, I suppose it is, but I mean, I would never forgive myself if I handed it over to a ghostwriter. As you say, I wrote for the Telegraph for 20 years, the Standard the year before that, and I'm writing for the London Evening Standard again now. So it's all come around in a big circle. So, yeah, I definitely wanted to do it. I just feel you can get more of an authentic voice on the page if you do it that way rather than coming through a third party. So, it's a challenging thing to do. Of course it is. I've been used to writing 800, 1,000 words on some subject, and then all of a sudden you've got to elaborate, and that was something that I had to learn as I went along.
And how painstaking a process was it? Did you give it a couple of hours every night, or here and there, or fits and bursts, or how long did it take you?
Yeah, fits and bursts, I'd say, Joe. It took about a year on and off, but, you know, there were times when I didn't write days, maybe some weeks. On those occasions, you always feel a bit guilty, thinking, oh, I should have got something down today. I mean, sometimes, you know, you sit there and nothing comes out. Other days it does. But it was just fascinating looking back, to be honest with you, especially to the early days. The Arsenal period, obviously, is in the more recent past, but my Leicester career between 82 and 87, that took a little bit of delving and research, talking to people. And before that at Alf Church and my boyhood years. But the more you look back, the more you remember, and that's why it was such an interesting journey to go on.
And who do you eventually hand over the finished text to and say, please tell me this isn't terrible?
I kind of passed it over in chapters, in chunks, and get a bit of feedback off the publisher. You know, tell us more about this, Alan. Go in that direction instead of this. So it just kind of tricks of the trade that publishers know about. But it seemed to be well received. I gave it my all. Just tried to be as honest, I think, and as open as I possibly could be.
Yeah.
Because I've never really been that sort. I've always, as I said in the preface, I've always been somebody that has liked to keep my head under the radar, so to speak, never really liked creating headlines. But, you know, if I was going to write, I've always been honest, though. So if I was going to write a book, I was always going to give it the warts and all version.
There's tons in it I could talk to you about. I might just pick out certain bits which jumped out at me. So you mentioned the Leicester years, and Gary Lineker was your partner there. Obviously, everybody very familiar with Gary. And you seemed to strike up a really great partnership. At one point, he said to you, in fairness, Alan, we weren't dopey footballers, so we were able to kind of figure it out ourselves, you know. And he's the poster boy, Leicester boy, obviously very, very popular. His pre-match routine is pretty interesting, and even his general application in training jumped out at me.
Yeah, I mean, he wasn't a big lover of training. I mean, when I went to see him, he said, I did like training, but only certain aspects of it. He didn't like five-a-sides because he thought the goals were too small and it knocked your confidence. I'd never heard that off him before, actually. And there were plenty of occasions where he'd have a little groin strain or whatever, something's a bit tight and he'd rest it. There's us running around the perimeter of the training ground, looking across at him. But we could never have a go at Gary because come match day, come Saturday, he flew out the traps. That's just what suited him, that build up. You know, he didn't need to be at it Monday to Friday. Even on a match day, it wasn't an extended warm up with him. He'd run a bath, really hot bath, just a couple of inches, and stand in that and do a few stretches. He wouldn't go out onto the pitch to do a warm up like most of us. Once he got out, he'd get on his kit and he'd be ready.
What science was this based on? That's what struck me, the image of Lineker in the hot water doing some stretches before a match. Did he just dream this up himself?
Well, his toes got warm anyway, if nothing else did. The old DP came out afterwards, I think. Yeah. But he made that one up himself. And, you know, when you're scoring every week, you tend to stick with it.
It's amazing, really, just how different football was back when you got going with Leicester. I mean, you talk about the attendances at Filbert Street, one game against Watford, you say 12,000. And then there was even that quote in the Times that you mentioned, whereby 85, obviously famously, is Heysel and the Bradford disaster and Luton Millwall riots and English teams banned out of competition. The Times that year described football as a slum sport played in slum stadiums and increasingly watched by slum people.
And that's quite brutal, that, isn't it?
It sure is. Yeah. It's amazing how it's changed. Were you conscious of that at the time, or was it just all you'd ever known and you never gave too much thought to the general state of the game?
I think hooliganism, you always thought, oh no, you know, there's been trouble again, there's been a fight outside. But, you know, 60s, 70s, it had been around, hadn't it? And it carried on into the 80s. So it was a part of life, really. You just accepted it. And the state of the stadiums too. Although, you know, as players, we didn't get to, you know, use the facilities, as it were. Mm. You know, some of them were dumps, you know, and Filbert Street wasn't the most palatial ground in the world. And it's funny now, like with the King Power, it's a lovely stadium facilities and it's full every week. But that has to do, obviously, with the appeal of football as well. But, different times, you know. I tell a story of when my wife, girlfriend, she came to watch a match against Chelsea and she's just about to get out of the car and, like, this horde of Chelsea fans came chasing past. There's blood and glass everywhere and they jumped back in the car, her and her brother. Had to tiptoe over glass after that when they got out eventually, and stuff like that was a regular occurrence.
And on the field, it's no fun either. Like, two incidents jump out. I'm sure you've been asked plenty about them over the course of doing interviews for the book. There's one where Graeme Souness, no shrinking violet, blatantly going over the top to plant six studs into my shin pad. Such was the force of the impact, I felt the shin bend inwards. Which is a fairly scary moment. Let's not have that shin bend anymore.
No, it's painful even now, thinking about it.
The constant threat of leg breakers is flying around in the game for a long time in your era.
Yeah, I mean, clever players like Graham could make it look fairly innocent.
Yeah.
You know, I always think the dirtiest players were the best players, you know, the likes of Johnny Giles and the like. They were just very cunning, weren't they? They could leave one on you. Dennis Bergkamp was like that, you know. He had that steely streak.
Did you have a dirty streak?
No.
No. And one yellow card?
One yellow card. I was too nice. Yeah. that was something George Graham would say. You know, he'd like to see a bit more devil in me. And I would have, to be fair. I mean, I talk about it in the book. I would have liked to have had that extra edge, that bit of nastiness in me. But you can't be something you're not. I always looked at Mark Hughes as my kind of centre forward, and he had that, you know. And I think if I had had that in my character, I would have maybe been able to get to the next level.
Yeah, at one point you sort of at one point you almost make the point, maybe I was just too well adjusted for my own bloody good when it comes to professional sport. Like, you've got a great family life, it seems, growing up, and very hardworking parents, and they'll have half a sausage themselves and give you and your brother a full sausage. So you've got this very loving environment. And I don't know, without us going into amateur psychology, which we're not equipped to do, maybe there is a certain damage somewhere along the way which gives you that edge when it comes to professional sport. Or so you want to prove people wrong. You didn't quite seem to have it in that capacity.
No, I mean, I always had great support from my mum and dad without them ever really pushing me and getting on my back. I mean, I tell a story of a lad I played with at county level and his dad was on him throughout the full 90 minutes. And I felt sorry for him, little midfielder, Victor Hollier. My dad would have a little word every now and again. They wanted me to do well. Dad loved his football. Mm. But you are a product of your childhood, I think. There's always a story behind it. I was never having to prove anybody wrong. I mean, to a certain extent, maybe I did, because people felt I was maybe too nice, too laid back.
Yeah.
But you've got to have that steely determination, you know, being nice and laid back is not going to get you anywhere in the professional game. You've got to have that real determination to do well. I've always been good at applying myself, whether it's been in my studies or in my football. I've tried to give it my all, and that's what I did.
There's definitely, I mean, along with the Souness moment, which sounds like zero fun, and thankfully your shin remained intact, the other kind of standout moment where you stop reading the book for a second and put your hand to your mouth is when your three teeth, front teeth, are knocked out courtesy of Steve Bold. I don't even think he gets a yellow card, you say. The feeling of three teeth popping out is no fun.
Well, no. I mean, you know, little did I know that Boldy would become a great mate and teammate, but... just received the ball in the centre circle, chested it, and it's just bounced up in front of my face, and his big leg came around the side, his size 12 boot just whacked into my face, and I just thought he'd cut my mouth because I felt my mouth, there was a bit of blood there. I went down onto one knee, and that's when Mark Chamberlain, Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain's dad, started picking up these things off the grass and handing them to the ref and saying, oh, I think these might be Alan's. They were my teeth. And they'd come out by the root so I could go off to Leicester Infirmary and have them put them straight back in again.
Not until your manager says, but you're all right to carry on, Smudge, aren't you?
Yes.
You can keep playing.
But yeah, that was actually Jerry Summers, our coach. Yeah, I've kind of gone to the touchline and he's gone, you're okay, aren't you, Smudge? I said, well, I'm not. I've got lost three teeth. I'm off. That was that.
It's a different world. The move to Arsenal comes along. I mean, there's a few flirtations. More so, Alex Ferguson's interested, phones the house at one stage. Obviously, it's not what Manchester United ultimately became, but it still gives you pause for thought. And Ken Bates was sniffing around at Chelsea. Mm. But it was Arsenal where you ended up. The thing, I suppose, which jumps out, and it's just so different to today, obviously, is the negotiations, and someone tells you, well, look, you're the bright new thing, they want you, and you're going to be a free agent in the summer anyway. It's 100 grand a year, and it should be 100 grand a year. And I don't know to this day to what big an extent, but certainly they offer 60, and you pretty much don't say, well, you know, well, I want 120, let's double it and let's settle on 100. You kind of just accept the 60 ultimately, and naive is the word you use. It kind of bugs you when you look back, really, at how naive you were.
It does. I don't know if it's naivety. I just didn't have the bottle to go through with it because I was on my own. I've never had a close relationship with an agent, really, and obviously that would have been very handy at that time. They weren't as prevalent as they are now. One or two had them. But I was in Ken Fryer, the managing director's, living room discussing salary and that, just on my own. And yes, I'd been given this figure by Vic Crowe, the former Aston Villa manager, who was a member of the golf club where my girlfriend's mum was stewardess, and which was fine. But when they said 60, and I tried to push them a little bit, but yeah, you can't help thinking back to times like that, but you can't get too caught up with it because that's just how it was. And at the end of the day, I'd signed for the Arsenal and I went on. And the important thing is my timing was perfect. I signed for Arsenal just at the start of big things for the club, so I couldn't be too disappointed.
No, it's true. And to be fair, you were not alone in being underpaid at Arsenal at that time. George Graham was not exactly throwing money at players. I mean, Tony Adams having to go in to negotiate bonuses, which were a big thing in that era of football and an important thing, especially when you're winning. I mean, even Adams came out after an hour sitting down with George Graham fairly unequipped to deal with him.
Well, he was a young lad, Tony, wasn't he? I mean, he was made captain at 21 and he was exactly what George wanted. He was kind of malleable. He was his voice on the pitch. But as for representing the lads in money negotiations and that, he was pretty hopeless at that stage. We'd shove him in, go on, Tone, go and tell the gaffer we want more money, we want better bonuses, because they weren't the best. So he'd go in just before training. He'd be in there about half an hour. You know, we're all waiting to go out and do our warm-up. What on earth's going on in there? He'd eventually come out and we'd be all going, yeah, Tone, what happened? And he'd go, oh, sorry, lads. He wouldn't shift, won't give you any more money, he said. But the good news is I've just signed a new 3-year contract. So he sorted himself out.
Yeah.
But that's how it was then. That's how it was. I mean, George ruled with an iron fist. He really did. And that included the money.
So let's talk about that then. Let's talk about Graham, because he's a very interesting figure in this book. And I'm sure lots of Arsenal fans will be very curious to read what you made of him. Graham arrives. I mean, he's part of the double winning side of 71. He's a flamboyant figure, immaculately dressed, you know, on match days, charismatic, forceful, nicknamed Gaddafi because he did rule.
Yeah, at one point,
with an iron fist. I come away very torn over Graham in this book, I have to say. It's a very nuanced picture. There's great respect for him and his many positive attributes, and then there are real failings there as well. So, like, for instance, maybe I'll start with a negative. He could be tough. Like, his treatment of Paul Davis, for instance, is very hard to forget. You might just explain, you know, what happened there with Davis.
Yeah, Paul Davis, vastly talented midfield player, lovely, elegant left foot. He didn't like the style of football at the time. He felt it was going over his head a little bit too much. We weren't playing through midfield. He made the mistake of putting these thoughts into a newspaper article, which George, you know, absolutely hated.
Yeah.
So he's made Davo go and train with the youth team. So this goes on for a number of weeks and then 3 months, something like that. Davo thinks, this is no good. I've got to go and see him. If he's not going to get me and put me back in the first team, I've got to get away.
Yeah.
So he goes in and says, look, boss, you know, you obviously don't rate me. You're upset. I want to leave. He said, Paul, you know, you might be upset, but you're not going anywhere. You're not going anywhere. And he sent him back. And he actually trained with the youth team for 18 months. I mean, I'd forgotten about this before I spoke to Davo. 18 months he was in the wilderness, which now it just wouldn't be possible. And I know Davo is very resentful. He's still bitter about it. And why wouldn't you be? Because you've robbed somebody of 18 months of their career.
Yeah.
But managers could do that then. They were so powerful. And, of course, I mean, if you're on 150 grand a week now, the owner's not going to stand for it, is he? Why aren't you using this player? If you don't want him, sell him. Players have all the power. But back then, you were at the mercy, really, of the gaffer.
Yeah, that story almost is vindictive, really, it seems. He could have sold him. You know, 6 months is enough time to rot in the reserves.
I mean, listen, I had an awful lot of respect. That was, as I say in the book, that was the George we didn't like,
sure,
the one we feared. But on the flip side, we all really respected him. And we knew he was a good manager, a good tactician, and we experienced some great times together.
And we associate him with, you know, the back four and all that business. But actually, he was a really good coach for you. Things like hold a play, you talk in the book, you know, instead of just banging your back into a player, he wants you side on so you can hold them off. And he's into the minutiae of making you a much better striker.
Yeah, he is, yeah. I mean, he was an attacking player himself.
Yeah.
He was also a really good header of the ball. And he used to impersonate how he wanted you to use your neck muscles like that. He's like a chicken. He'd walk along doing this head action. So we'd all laugh behind his back. But I think his first port of call was sorting that defence out. And like the likes of me, Paul Merson, Rocky and Brian Marwood, we'd try and break this back four down in training for hours on end. And they got so good at it. I mean, if you ever slipped through, it was party time. It was a great achievement. But then he'd come up towards the end of the session and do shooting and various bits of technique. So he had a handle on everything. He was always on the training ground. It was rare that he wasn't. And on the days that he wasn't, you know, you kind of go, oh, we can have a little jolly up today. We can relax. The gaffer's not here.
Yeah. You talk at one stage in the book, I think it's around the time Graham is leaving, about how, you know, ultimately you want to look back on a career and not feel it's passed you by, to have great moments. And you certainly had that in your career. Two league titles, a European Cup Winners' Cup, an FA Cup, a League Cup, Golden Boots, twice in 89 and 91, and your England caps as well. I guess a crowning moment, or certainly the most dramatic moment that we'll all remember from afar, is Anfield and 1989, where you need to go there to, I mean, it's bloody Liverpool, and it was, you know, Liverpool then were so extraordinary and win by two goals. That is a real crowning moment for everybody, of course, but certainly for Graham, and not least going to three at the back, you know, the logic being that Dixon and Winterburn can push up on Ray Houghton and John Barnes. And you talk about the way he imbued the team with a sense of belief. And you say his halftime team talk was his finest moment as well. What an extraordinary night.
It was an incredible one. You know, the circumstances of it, the two teams vying for the title, going head to head after everybody else had finished, and the fixture had been put to the end due to the Hillsborough tragedy. So all eyes were on this match on a Friday night. I think it got 18 million on ITV. Hmm. kickoff was delayed. There was bad traffic on the M6. My wife didn't get there till 5 minutes before the end of the first half. She didn't miss anything because in that first 45, Baldy had a header that was cleared off the line by Steve Nicol. Apart from that, it was just such a 100-mile-an-hour match. It never slowed down. And the one thing that struck me when I watched it back were the tackles flying in, ferocious tackles, and players collapsing to the turf but getting straight up, brushing themselves down, getting on with it, the ref not making a song and dance of it. And you do wish football could be a bit more like that now. It's obviously become so sanitised, but nobody trying to get somebody else in trouble, even though the stakes were so high. But yeah, we came in at half-time, heads down a bit. You know, we were a bit disconsolate. Oh, we need to score two, but we've hardly had a chance. But George lifted us because his one point was clean sheet, lads, clean sheet. Forget about the two goals, we'll get them. If we concede, we've got to get three, forget it. So we had kept that clean sheet at half-time, and he was just lifting us, saying it's all going perfectly according to plan. Let's just push on a bit more now, get Lee and Nigel further forward, get some crosses into the box. We will score, and we will get the second. I think we'll get the third, he said. Mm. So he was Nostradamus that night, and he really did send us out in a clear frame of mind, you know, in the way that Liverpool lads weren't. They felt, you know, that you could lose a game 1-0 and still win the title. Mm. That's a funny situation to go into a match with. So we knew exactly how to play it. And you know, funnily enough, I was fairly confident we'd do it, or I thought we had a chance anyway.
Yeah.
Although Liverpool were the form team, we'd struggled towards the end. They caught us up.
Yeah.
I think they were unbeaten in the last 21 or something like that.
Yeah.
And what a team they were with Rush and Barnes, Beardsley, Hansen, Aldridge. They had them all. I mean,
yeah, it was outrageous.
Formidable at Anfield especially. So, I mean, incredible night.
And an extraordinary night for so many reasons. I mean, the backdrop of Hillsborough you mentioned, it's why the game is on May 26th, which is so late in the season. And we had Lee Dixon on, who I know you say in the book you're good friends with. And he was on around the time of that 89 documentary a while back. And he was just talking about the atmosphere pre-game and that wonderful gesture to bring the flowers onto the pitch and then give them to the fans. I'll just play a clip here of Lee, who gave a brilliant interview that night on the show a couple of months ago, and his memory of even just that particular moment, with the effect that Hillsborough had even on Arsenal players.
It was so traumatic, and it was such a big thing that, you know, 96 people, it's just horrific to even think about it now. And it's in the middle of the football, towards the end of a football season, and that has still got games to play. How can you? That's what I thought. I just thought, how can you carry on going back to, you know, that excitement that you get to go into a football match and the place? Certainly, I was looking from the player's point of view. How do I get myself in the right frame of mind to try and beat the person I'm playing against and put the ball in the net and fight and do all the stuff that you need to do in order to produce a performance when people have just died at a football match? How's that work? I couldn't really get my head around it. And so when they said, you know, there's a 2-week break, I thought, oh, well, you know, at least it gives me time to try and work out what to do. And I think George gave us a few days off. Then we were back to training, and then it was, you know, he talked about the fact that it's out of our hands. We just have to go and do our job, and it's almost like a relief then. It gives you as a footballer, it gives you an out to go back into being a footballer and saying, okay, right, well, other people are going to take care of the other stuff. We've just got to get on with playing. And so you can kind of escape it a little bit from, I felt as if we were, not escape, running away from it, but we were almost allowed to go back to playing. And then it's funny because once you start playing again, it's not like it's never happened, because I still felt the burden of it right up until, I say in the documentary, literally right up until I passed the flowers over on the night at Anfield to a lady at the front of the cop. Right up until that moment, I felt there was a weight in my chest just going, is it right? Is it right that we're still playing football? I didn't realise it at the time, but now when I look back on it, I could feel that heaviness, and passing the flowers over was almost like permission from her and everybody else at Liverpool and the cop and was almost say, "Oh no, it's okay. Let's play. We, you know, we need to play this game."
Lee Dixon there. What an extraordinary backdrop to a game.
Yeah, no, it was. It was. I mean, Lee describes it perfectly. I think it was Ken Fryer's idea to arm us with these bouquets, and obviously that brings it all back to you when you're running out, and it was obviously very well received. We got a great round of applause as we all went to four corners of the ground. I went to the opposite side from the tunnel. I think I gave them to a lady as well. But I do, the one thing I remember after that, then everybody gets back into position and there's this like primeval roar scream goes up, because then everybody is then thinking about the next 90 minutes almost as an escape, perhaps. And, you know, I've never played in an atmosphere like it. And I think that transmitted itself to the match in the way how fast it was with those tackles flying in. The ball was given away a lot. You know, we'd have it for 10 seconds, they'd have it. There was no pattern to the game. It was just tear 'em, scare 'em.
Yeah. It's actually worth mentioning the reception you got at full time. The cop stays full, you get a round of applause. Champagne arrives in from the home dressing room into your dressing room. Peter Beardsley sticks his head around to say, "Well done." It's a real classy reaction from Liverpool. So that's a crowning moment for Graham. And you had 8 years together. I guess the story which jumps out is probably the one you've been asked about, is after 8 years together, when he turns on you at one point in the dressing room after a poor performance from everyone, and he's going around to different people, and he gets to you, and it's, and you see, you're always on the treatment table, never fit, and then you put in a performance like that. And you say in the book, "I couldn't believe what I just heard. He's just called me a C. He's just called me a C, the manager with whom I'd shared so many good times. Don't call me a C." And you even say later on, when you're reflecting in the final chapter, that when you think about that moment, it will still get your heckles up a little bit. And, you know, you spend a few days daydreaming about what you would have liked to have said back to him, give him a few home truths of his own.
But yeah.
Yeah, I mean, a part of me kind of thought, well, manager calling a player a C, that would have just been the era and that would have been commonplace, but clearly not.
No, it wasn't actually, coming from George. I mean, he loved a rollicking. Of course he did.
Yeah.
But, you know, I was one of a core of players that had been through so much with him, achieved so much, been so successful. And he never used language like that. And so for him to call me out in that way, it just shocked me so much. It really cut me to the quick. I couldn't believe it. And as you say, I was kicking myself, because if he'd have said that to somebody else, there might have been a little, you know, face to face, there could have been a fight breaking out. But me being the kind of person that I am, I confronted him about it, but not as aggressively as perhaps I should have, and come back with something of my own. As you say, words that you think of when it's too late. But I think that was all a reflection of what he was going through at the time. You know, he started behaving differently. There was all the bong rumours going around, and it was actually Lee Dixon that first made us aware of them. I don't know who he got this from, but he said, you know, "George is in big trouble, he's heading for the sack," and we went, "Nah, don't be stupid." But you know, it was bubbling under. That was New Year's Eve 94, and it was only a matter of weeks later, really, before he was dismissed in the February. You can imagine what was going on in his mind, in his life at the time, so maybe that contributed towards it, how he behaved to us.
Yeah, a very generous, I think, assessment from you. I guess a last point to touch on, your modesty, I suppose, is a feature in the book, and not putting yourself forward or looking for attention, and that is your character. Even at one point you say maybe you didn't have the right temperament for the Arsenal number 9, and almost your life now is quite nice when you're recognised without that pressure. But your golden boot winner twice, the night at Anfield in 89, you pip John Aldridge, and then you do it again in 91. It's amazing that you talk about how sometimes people go, "Oh, did you win it twice? Were you Golden Boot winner?"
Yeah, like,
and,
yeah.
You know, we all know Gary Lineker was Golden Boot winner. We all know certain players were Golden Boot winner. It had escaped me that you had done it twice as well. It's not like it's in your Twitter bio or something that you do. And even you talk at the time where you were flicking through a magazine when you had won the Golden Boot for the second time. And Nike have taken out an ad with Ian Rush, who's their guy, and it's, "Can Rush win back the Golden Boot from Alan Smith next season?" You know, and you kind of think, fair enough, he's Nike's guy. But then, as you point out, hang on, I'm Nike's guy too. I'm sponsored by Nike. Why is it not like Alan Smith, golden boot winner with Nike? Graham saying, would you not step forward and take the penalties? And it's an extra 5 goals a season. So, you know, I guess it ties in maybe with accepting the money at Arsenal or accepting certain things. Definitely a feature of your character, which is not in keeping with the number nine of a league-winning, golden boot-winning player.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, when I had goal droughts, I did suffer, and I maybe found it harder to get back on the trail than other players. I mean, the penalty thing was something I just wasn't confident about. I mean, I could have scored another 7, 8, 9 goals perhaps a season.
Yeah.
George tried to encourage me to do it, but I didn't fancy it. It's just the way I was. Mm. When I was scoring, I just felt I was going to score every single match, and you know, everything did go in. Mm. I didn't score for the first 10 games, I think, in 1991, and I ended up winning the Golden Boot. So it just shows you I hardly stopped after that. Then when I get to the period when Ian Wright joined, and I really struggled, really suffered.
That was fascinating, actually, because, I mean, you're a Golden Boot winner in 91. This kid's coming up from Crystal Palace, and he should be kind of in awe of you. And you say at one point almost his self-assuredness was almost intimidating. It was inspiring for everyone else. I understand why the difference. I mean, if he's up front with you, it's different for Lee Dixon to find him inspiring.
Yeah.
You say the thing with Wright was he was just working off instinct. He was unpredictable. George Graham had movement fairly choreographed. If Lee Dixon had the ball, there were certain movements and runs and patterns. And you know, Ian Wright, like Tasmanian Devil, had suddenly crop up in your space. And the regret you have is you never actually broached this with Wright or with Graham or with anyone, really.
No, I mean, I've never been a great one for confrontation and shy away from it. So I didn't really have it out. I should have had a talk. Whether it would have done any good, I don't know. I went to see a sports psychologist, but it didn't do too much good. It was a chap that had worked with us, with England under Graham Taylor. But the little exercise he gave me didn't really work. It's an eternal regret that those last 3 years of my career were really poor ones, but for Copenhagen.
And did anyone, like, so you go from golden boot winner, literally golden boot winner, to your last 3 years, 3 goals, 3 goals, 2 goals. It strikes me as mad that almost no one sat down and said, well, like, what's happened? Clearly there's something weird going wrong, or something that's wrong, something's gone wrong in the team, be it Ian Wright or be it something else here. That was never addressed, you know, like your golden boot winner doesn't just suddenly go 3, 3 and 2.
Yeah, maybe it would be addressed now. I don't know. I suppose the fact we were a successful team in terms of the cups maybe masked the problem to a certain extent. We had a great back four. You know, that's when 1-0 to the Arsenal came into force, really. But it's so disappointing to be title challengers and then all of a sudden you're just a cup team. But no, it wasn't addressed. I should have forced the issue, really, because it was just a miserable time for me. I didn't look. I always loved training previously, always loved it, but almost dreaded it then, because in finishing practice, whatever, I just didn't know what I was doing.
Yeah,
it was such a strange thing to happen, really.
Yeah, amazing. Was it, did you sort of say you felt Ian Wright sensed something?
Well, he must have, because you know he's seen me, you know, banging in the goals for Arsenal, winning leagues and winning golden boots. And he must have thought, God, is this his twin brother or something? You know, missing these chances. So he must have been fairly shocked, but not as shocked as I was.
I can imagine.
You know, we did change the way we played. We didn't have so much width. We didn't have wingers, really. And the lads in midfield, Wright, he would demand it. He'd make a run over the back and he'd get it and he'd score. So, you know, why would you stop doing that? But
yeah.
That's not to say that wasn't the sole reason for my struggles. I did have chances, but I missed them quite often, fumbled them. You just look back and you think, oh, God, I wish I could. If I could have just got, let's say, 10, 15 goals in those last 3 years, you know, you saw the all-time Arsenal scoring chart, and that would have been nice. But, you know, as I say at the end, you can't have too many. There's always going to be disappointments, and you can't have too many regrets. Somebody like me having won what I did.
Yeah, it's true. My heart sort of breaks for you, though. You know, like, it's a dog-eat-dog world in all industries, and especially in football. And so Ian Wright's doing his thing, and even the emerging Kevin Campbell arrives into training one day with the reg plate Kev 9.
That's right.
And you're like, That is my number. I'm still here. Like, what is going on? It's a cruel world.
Yeah, yeah, it is. I mean, I don't know. That's just one of those things. I didn't talk to Kev about it. What the hell's going on? If it had happened to Brighty, I'm sure he would have had it out with him. But that was just me.
The end comes quick. It's an injury, and in 4 months you're outside London Independent Hospital with Gary Loon, and he's saying, "I'm so sorry," and it's over. You seem to have adjusted as well as anyone can hope to do, and Sky Sports has happened, and The Telegraph, and FIFA, and all of these kind of mad things, and you write a lovely chapter about your family as well, and just how supportive they've been. So the 20 years since have been a pretty good innings, is the general sense I get from you to wrap up.
Definitely, yeah. I've been so lucky. I mean, I can understand how players struggle. Once they finish, it's such a sharp cut-off. One day you've got 20 mates, you're going into training, having a laugh and a joke. The next day, you're on the outside looking in.
Yeah.
And you've just got to find something to do. I did that. I was determined. I had to support my family for a start off. I hadn't earned enough money that I could just sit on my backside.
Well, there's a terribly sad moment where you ask your daughters for memories towards the end, and your daughter, who was 5 at the time, can remember your retirement and almost send. She absorbed almost the worry and financial worry, and God, you're kind of a bit jolted all these years later to realise that, because we don't know half of what our kids pick up on. So
yeah,
like, that's what's going on in your life.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. I said to Jessie, my eldest, I didn't know if you kind of felt like that. She was only 5 at the time, but it was such an uncertain time, because you've lost that career, that life that you were so used to, and you've lost the income, and there's so much uncertainty lying ahead. So I just thought I'd get my head down here and do whatever. I got into the writing, and the Sky stuff built from there. I've been so fortunate.
Yeah.
I was never really interested in coaching. It was never something that appealed. I think some lads go into it because it's the only thing they know, football, and they might not particularly enjoy it, whatever, or be good at it, but that's what they do. But thankfully, I could put an article together. I can speak okay, so yeah. I got into broadcasting, and to be involved in the game in this way has been a dream, a real dream. I've commentated on Champions League finals. I've been to World Cup finals for the Telegraph. So it's been such an amazing career afterwards, and I'm thankful for that.
For the bloke who had to be bullied to do interviews, you know, talk to millions of people by choice. It's worked that one out.
Yeah, that's true.
Congrats on the book. I mean, to write your own book as well is a real rarity. It's lovely to actually talk
Thank
to someone
you.
Where the words actually are familiar, because it doesn't actually always happen, believe it or not, when you're talking to people about their book. So heads up, Alan Smith. Best luck with it, and continued success in the career, Alan. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Joe. Thank you.
Football on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by the Boyle Sports app. Cash out and in-play betting available in the App Store and Google Play Store.